Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everybody, this is Phil Town.
And this is Danielle Town.
And this is the Invested Podcast being brought to you from Zurich, Switzerland, and Jackson Hole, Wyoming today.
Indeed.
Yes.
We've been all over the place, Dad. And
haven't we?
We've been putting up some vault episodes. And I think hopefully we're going to get some chats here now that I'm back in Zurich because I've been visiting you, which has been amazing, and visiting our other family in the U.S. And then I just got back home a little bit ago and adjusting. It's just been a whirlwind and wonderful and the best hugs and medicine I could ever have.
It was so great having you out at the farm. It was just incredible. And now, strangely, I'm back home in a weird
You are. Way. That's true. By the way, the birthplace of the Invested Podcast, too.
Exactly. Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Lived here for a long, long time. This is where Danielle graduated from high school. And
I didn't graduate from high school there, but we lived there
didn't
when
you?
I graduated
oh, no, you
from
didn't.
High
you
school.
You sort of went to high school here, but you chose to go to a different high school, right?
Yes.
That's right. I forgot. you know, keeping up. I'm getting old. It all is a blur.
Yeah. But
what's not a blur is the moment I landed here in Jackson Hole, I could feel that same energy that I felt the first time I came here. It really is a special place. And it's
Jackson just has it. Yeah,
fantastic.
I agree. There is that energy there. I miss it a lot.
With Michael Nichols, who is
the best,
sort of one of the just best people on the planet. He's working here at the Four Seasons where I'm staying. He's been here forever, and he and I coached volleyball together. We started the Jackson Hole team, traveling volleyball team, and Michael's continued to keep it going. And it's just we had lots of adventures here, driving kids to Salt Lake City and flying them to Hawaii and all that kind of stuff for the volleyball
stuff.
Yeah,
you did a lot with that volleyball stuff. Yeah, that's true. Hey, is Jackson Hole volleyball like still going? Like, is there still a good program there?
Yeah, Michael said they're still going.
Sweet.
Still going.
Good.
It's fun. I mean, I was up snowboarding yesterday with an instructor named Carter, who's coaching kids 5th and 6th grade level at the elementary school in lacrosse.
Nice.
So more and more of these team sports, you know, sort of like no contact sport, no head injury sport kind of things are coming along.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty great. It's just pretty great having the kids get involved in stuff outdoors. I mean, Jackson Hole, of course, is just outdoor heaven. So
So tell everybody why you're intensively snowboarding in Jackson right now.
Yeah, I gave myself 2 weeks to get myself in shape to do 3 days of helleboarding out in the Ruby Mountains with Ruby Mountain Heliski. It's a helicopter operation that has the entire Ruby Mountain range at their disposal, which is a place between Salt Lake City and Reno, Nevada, out in the middle of the desert near Elko. And I've been there several times. I really love it. It's 3 days, great heliskiing. And if the weather comes in, they have snowcats. And we're going to go there, family trip. And a couple of my analysts are going with me who snowboard. And it's torturing to
hear you all talk about it. I'm doing my best to like be chill and cool and not kill myself inside for not going on this. But
well, we're both
it's gonna be so awesome.
It is gonna be great. But we're both sort of doing the same thing. You're getting yourself back in shape.
Yeah.
Over a long process.
Trying to
getting there. You're doing it. It's happening. And I'm getting myself back in shape. I kind of thought I was sort of pretty good shape, decent shape. But I gave myself a couple of weeks here in Jackson to just get on the groomers and just get my legs better, you know, because in the heliskiing thing, you're going to be doing 15 to 18,000 vertical feet a day, which doesn't sound like that much. There's people out here who, lots of them, that do 36,000 vertical in a day. And some people who really push it do a lot more than that. But, you know, 15, 16,000 in deep snow is a thing.
So for perspective, because probably we have people listening who don't ski and or pay no attention to vertical feet or whatever, from the top of like a big ski area to the bottom, would you say this is right? I would say maybe it's like 2,000 vertical feet, maybe on average. Maybe, yeah, I would say like 2,000.
In a smaller ski area, it would be something like that. I think in most ski areas have, well, I shouldn't say smaller. Most ski areas have 2,000 to 3,000 vertical.
Yeah, somewhere in there.
Jackson Hole's 4,000.
Yeah, but that's if you go like all the way to the top and then all the way to the bottom.
Right.
So just for some perspective, so maybe you do like, you know, if you're somebody who goes all the way to the top of the ski area and then all the way to the bottom and you do that like five times, let's say that's 10 to 15,000 vertical. And that's like very tiring to do five times top,
well,
all the way to the bottom.
If you and if you then keep going, your legs start to burn. That's
imagine
for sure.
That you're in deep snow the right. entire time.
Right.
And you don't stop a lot because you're not stopping to figure out like which run to take and you know, where's the rest of the group and stuff. And so
even worse than that, you don't stop
massive.
A lot because your group typically wants to get as many lifts as they can get in.
Yeah.
And so you come down probably half the run. So the typical run out there, I think, is about 2,500 vertical. You come down about 1,200 vertical, and you're just motoring through deep snow. And you stop briefly, collect everybody up together, and down you go for the rest of it.
Yeah, it's
and you
so
just
fun.
Keep doing that.
It's
That's
so
really
much
fun.
I'm so proud of you for.
To put this in perspective, I just have to tell everybody, I really should post this up. It's just an epic journey for an old guy.
Well, that's why I'm proud of you, because you've made this commitment. Like, you booked this. When was that? 6 months ago? 9 months ago? It was a long time ago.
Yeah, I knew I was going to need it.
And you were like, let's do it. I'm going to get in shape.
I thought I was in fairly good shape. I was doing my lean against the wall squats, right, for a minute and a half, you know, and all this. Hello. I got out here the first day and I came down about 4,000 vertical, essentially one run from the top. I was wasted. My legs were gone. They had hit maximum and failed multiple times coming down the hill, like where I just have to sit down and wait for 10 minutes. I mean, just the movement of compression over and over and over again is just wipes out your muscles if you're not used to it.
But it's also the elevation, Dad. And that's also
that.
A big reason I'm so glad that you are in Jackson and like just sitting there for sleeping there for two weeks so that you are not just utterly gassed by being up at 11,000, 12,000 feet when you're
so far so good. I've done one, two, three in a rest day. And then yesterday I did 7,000 vertical. So I'm like, okay.
Nice.
And I wasn't too bad. It wasn't too bad.
I
didn't really feel like, okay, now I got to lock my knees and crash because I wasted my thighs.
Sweet.
So 7,000. Today I'm going to go for 9,000. See if I can get that. See how we're doing.
When you called and asked, you were very sweet and you did ask if I wanted to go, which was a fait accompli, obviously, but I seriously was like, I am going to think about this for 24 hours. And then in that 24 hours, I happened to have an appointment with my physical therapist who like literally, I mean, I can't do squats because I get dizzy if my head moves up and down like that. And I can't do like side stuff because I get dizzy in my head. So like just for perspective, that's where we're at. So I walked into my physical therapist and I was like, can I go heli skiing in March of next year? And he was like, you could just tell he didn't want to tell me no because yay, stay positive and all that. And he was kind of like, and I said, yeah, it's crazy, right? Like, it's totally nuts. And he said, I think maybe like we could have that as like a cool idea for a little bit later. And in the meantime, I think I would say even maybe go snowboarding one time before going heli skiing in the mountains. And I was like, oh, excellent point. Yeah, let's have that be a goal. I'll go snowboarding one time.
I have to say, sweetheart.
He was so sweet about it.
You know, the character
Eve,
reveals itself.
I love you. If he's listening, I love you.
Character reveals itself in adversity is just a rule of life. This is when you really see who people are. And I just am so respectful of, and I so admire your attitude toward recovering from long COVID is just unbelievable. A lot of people have long COVID, millions of people do. And many of them are deeply depressed and non-functional and sort of their life is over. And you are fighting every day through this thing. And God, I just so admire you, honey. It's like, I'm so proud of you is what it boils down to. Proud of you that you're my daughter. I think you've accomplished so much in your life already, obviously. But this is, this is just a pinnacle. This is like the Mount Everest of accomplishments in my view. It's just such a huge challenge, and you're getting there every day, and I just appreciate it so much. I mean, look at you're still recording podcasts, which is through the brain fog, through all of that. It's just, wow, really something. Really something special.
Well, I mean, that's a lot due to you, because you carry me on this podcast and have been for a long time, and it's wonderful that I still get to do this with you.
Truth be known, this podcast wouldn't be much anything interesting if it wasn't for you. And that's a fact. I've had construction guys who are 50 years old come up, you know, covered with tattoos and totally muscled out, banging nails is their whole thing. And they're going like, I am Danielle Town. I'm like, okay.
I have the same questions. So cool. But I appreciate you saying that. That's really nice. And since occasionally we talk about this stuff, but I just saw my neurologist yesterday because I just got back to Zurich, and I'm like doing the rounds of doctors. And I will say, for anybody who's suffering from long COVID and might find this useful, one thing that has really changed my situation in the last 6 months is getting higher iron. And getting iron infusions, in fact, after trying the pills, which of course didn't work because they never work. So I have been hesitant to say that to people because everybody's situation is different and I don't know if that would be good for other people. But I just got sent, Nuno just sent me an article that I just read right before we started recording this from Cambridge, where they have an actual study now showing that low iron might be a huge contributor to long COVID symptoms, maybe connected to the inflammation, or the inflammation causes the low iron. They're not really sure how it all works, but there's now like evidence for a link. And if you're like me and your doctors constantly are talking about evidence-based protocols, and there are no evidence-based protocols for long COVID because it hasn't been around long enough to create any evidence, which is beyond frustrating. If you're like me and you sit in there and they say, well, there's no evidence for this to work, now there's a little bit of evidence. So maybe, you know, you can find that article from Cambridge and take it into your doctor and try it, because it's been really, really massive for my recovery to get some iron infusions in the last 6 months. Super okay. Cool. Enough doctor talk.
Super cool. Okay. Well, I can segue.
Okay.
Okay. Speaking of evidence. How's that for a segue? So, I mean, this is apropos of nothing we're going to be talking about today, but I just wanted to say there was an article out today in the New York Times about Unilever getting rid of Ben and Jerry's ice cream.
No way. I didn't see that. Huh.
Yeah. They're dumping Ben and Jerry's along with their other ice creams, because ice cream has eggs, and eggs are the number one highest inflation food product that there is. Hmm. I mean, eggs have inflated beyond belief.
Yeah, they have. That's true.
And then there's milk or cream or whatever else goes into it. But in the essence of it is that they've attempted to raise the prices at Ben and Jerry's, and they were unsuccessful.
Oh, people just stopped buying Ben and Jerry's ice cream.
Ben and Jerry's. They just went to a different brand. And I just wanted to bring this up because it's such a good example of what things look like when you don't have a moat, and you don't have a real one. Like everybody knows Ben and Jerry's ice cream. So you think, oh, well, they got a moat, right? It's a brand moat. We talk about brand moats. Similar to Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola has a brand moat. Now, here's where you really get to see the difference of a product with a brand moat is with inflation. When the prices start to rise, the costs start to rise in your product, and you do not have a big enough moat to be able to raise your prices with the rise in costs, then you start to lose revenue immediately. Yes. And this is a major sign of a very small moat or no moat at all. And clearly, Ben and Jerry's, as big a brand as that is, and everybody's heard of them, they don't have enough control of their consumer, the consumer's mind, to be able to raise prices into heavy inflation. Whereas a company like Coca-Cola absolutely does. They have raised prices with inflation now for 140 years successfully. And people stay with them because there's such a demand for that specific product. That's just very difficult. I mean, it sounds stupid because there's every sort of cola under the planet, but it's very difficult for Coke drinkers to replace Coke.
It is. Yeah.
They just don't.
I mean,
they
we all know it. Don't. It tastes different.
Yep. It just tastes different.
I mean, same with Pepsi. Some people love Pepsi.
Same thing with Pepsi. Absolutely right. So there are things that have control the consumer, and that is the kind of brand you're looking for. Not just, hey, I really have heard of them, right? That's not necessarily enough. So that's
really interesting because brand moats are something we've talked about because it's the one that I have the most trouble. One, it's the one I have the most trouble identifying, and two, it's the one that is like, I don't want to say it's the most common, but it's the one that like you see so much more than other moats because as a retail investor, as somebody, you know, investing my own money, I tend to look at companies I'm familiar with and those are consumer facing companies with brands. So right. That's the kind of thing that we, the people doing this at home just tend to see more, I think.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
So I'm always going like, is this just me knowing about a company and like they have advertisements that are good or whatever and they're like they make a good product right now? Does that actually mean a moat? And I don't know. I'm always like very suspicious of declaring a brand moat.
I'm with you.
I'm not sure it is an actual moat, to be honest, even for something like Coca-Cola. So
okay, fair enough. Because let's look at some of the. I'm just curious here. I just looked up sources on the web for Berkshire's consumer facing products, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is Heinz, and yeah. It's extraordinary.
It hasn't done very well.
No, they've had to write off like billions of dollars worth of equity in the Heinz purchase. Because they found out that the brands, which they thought were worth quite a lot, were not worth quite a lot. That
yeah, nobody
Costco
cares.
And Walmart have their own brands, and people just buy them because they're good and the price is low.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, you look at Geico, big brand. They get the great advertisements, and yet they compete on price for sure. Duracell. Still, they're in a fairly small number of companies. Dairy Queen, what a classic, right? I mean, does anybody go to Dairy Queen because it's Dairy Queen?
I would hope so. Why else would you go to Dairy Queen?
Because it's the next thing you see in a fast food place. I guess they have some sort of brand with their ice cream and stuff. But, you know, you could just see that. I think you're absolutely right. The branding stuff is difficult. Benjamin Moore.
It's part of it, but it's, yeah, I don't think it's enough. I mean, frankly, like, who really cares? It's about a combination of price and, well, it's value. I was going to say it's a combination of price and value, which boils down to value, really. Like, Berkshire owns Fruit of the Loom, which I actually hadn't really paid attention to until I went finally to the meeting a bunch of years ago, and they were selling all this. There's a whole corner of the convention center just for Fruit of the Loom underwear and socks and like t-shirts, which I just was like, why is anybody buying this here? Like, you can buy it at home, but they had all these really good deals on it and they sold out faster than any other part of that whole like selling convention center area. And that's another one where like, who cares if it's Fruit of the Loom? I don't. And I don't think anybody else does either. But you know that it's a combo of mm-hmm. pretty good quality for a mm-hmm. good price. Mm-hmm. It's not a brand that you're going to have something that falls apart within. Like, it should last for a while and it's at a good price. And that's their brand and that's why it's successful. And is that really a brand moat?
No, it's more of a
price
moat.
I don't think
moat.
It really is. Exactly. Yeah.
More of a price moat. I think NetJets might be another interesting example to ponder, because their brand is that they have the best flight safety, highest quality aircraft.
True.
And you come in as an owner.
We'll have one available for you. They have like a lot of planes, so they'll always have one available if you need one.
Top quality pilots. I mean, they're just the top quality. And when you think about it, you don't want to sacrifice quality at 30,000 feet in the air.
No.
You know, as we're watching Alaska Airlines have its doors fall off. So it's kind of like, I think I really would like to go with high quality. And if you can afford a private jet, then why not pay a little bit more and make sure you get there, you know?
Price shopping for your private jet's a little suspicious.
Right?
It'd be
like price shopping for someone who's doing eye surgery. It's just like, no,
exactly.
You don't really want to price shop that.
Exactly.
So those are the kinds of brands I think that really make a difference, right?
Yeah. Coca-Cola's so do we have a name for that? Because I think that's when you say brand moat, I think a lot of times what we're saying is quality moat.
Quality.
And the brand stands for quality, or the brand stands for value. Essentially, like good quality for the price.
Yeah, maybe so.
I don't know.
It's worth a look, because if you just think of the brand as a big name, it just feels like, wow, can you really be confident that that's going to be there 10 years from now?
No, and I never can be. I just cannot. I cannot.
Right? It kind of has to be about quality. I mean, you think about Duracell, it's been around a long, long time. I have confidence that if I buy that battery, it's going to be around, right?
I guess. I've never given a second thought to Duracell or Energizer or whatever other ones there are. You just pick the one that's in front of you.
Yeah, but the thing is, there's about two of them in front of you.
Right.
And then when you go to, if you think about going to like the Kirkland version, if I don't even know if they have one, of a battery, I'm like, no, I'll pay the extra 5 cents and get a battery that I know lasts pretty long time. So you see what I mean?
I don't remember what we
were
talking about.
Where were we when we were so rudely interrupted by the Four Seasons dropping their internet? Way to go, Four Seasons here in Jackson Hole. I got to say, probably not the Four Seasons. It's probably Jackson Hole somehow.
The hotel internet is not famously amazing. So that doesn't surprise me too much.
Well, fair enough. We were talking about brands.
Brand moats and stuff. Yeah.
And how weak most brand moats are. But that was sort of going to be an aside, just talking about Ben & Jerry's, but I didn't want to get us too far off track here, but we got way off track.
Yeah. So we got off on this brand moat situation when what we had intended to talk about today was actually Buffett's letter and the memorial that he put in at the beginning to Charlie, which I thought was going to have like some stories in it and some memories, and actually was very short and clear and to the point, which made a statement.
Yeah, absolutely. I just think that Warren loves Charlie, obviously, and there's never been a relationship quite like those two. If only for the length of the time they were together and friends and functional and powerful and affecting the whole world of investing at a minimum, and certainly the world of other companies that they were involved in. But my God, those guys go all the way back to about 1960 when they came together and have been a powerful, powerful team ever since. And extraordinarily to me is that Charlie's a dyed-in-the-wool Republican. I mean, seriously conservative. Warren's father was a serious conservative, but mm-hmm. Warren is a Democrat. Warren is a liberal all the way. And how those guys kept politics out of their lives for that period of time, as important as politics is to most people, is sort of miraculous and maybe a really good lesson for all of us.
Yeah, I don't find that surprising at all. Like, it's okay. Gosh, you have some slightly different views. I think they deeply respected the basis.
Hold on. Politics massively affects business. It massively affects the results of business. I mean, you know, if one political, I'm not even saying this is the case, but let's say one political party just believes in printing money endlessly and inflation is massive, that's a pretty significant political event. And to not stand against that would be pretty weird. I guess, in fact, in that particular point, Buffett's very much against massively inflating the currency, and so's Munger. So maybe they didn't disagree that much on the nitty-gritty political things. Maybe they just, you know, different parties. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say, that I don't think it really affected their relationship that much because they both deeply respected the basis of each other's viewpoints and didn't find them to be so contrary that they couldn't find that respect. And I think in many, we don't know anything. Well, we know some things about what Buffett thinks politically, but not that much. And not that much. I would say we knew more about what Munger thought. And they were not so opposite that you're making it sound, I would say.
No, there was a couple major differences. The one that I think of is that Buffett believes that you should have a system of government and politics where if you were to draw the weakest straw, let's say you're in heaven and you're going to get born, and you're going to draw a straw for where you're going to be born, what family, what politics, or rather what economics and so on. He would like a culture that would give that person the best leg up. The one where you wouldn't mind getting the smallest straw. And so I think that he would prefer that there is significant government intervention to make sure that that happens and that there's a sort of a leveler going on by government, whereas Charlie is like hands off and you get the best system. They both agree
maybe
that you should have the best system. But I think they have a pretty big difference in the way they looked at it. I don't want to get in a whole discussion with you about it.
Yeah, that's not what was in the memorial, just for anybody who hasn't read it. I don't want to mislead. That's not what was in his one pager.
I would say there's this dramatic respect that comes to Charlie from Warren. Obviously it goes both ways, but what Warren said was extraordinary, and that is that he gave Charlie all of the credit for what Berkshire became.
Yeah.
He said basically, I'm the construction manager, Charlie's the architect.
Yeah.
He said, I just built it, but I built what Charlie said to build.
Yeah. He said those exact words. Yeah. I am the construction manager and Charlie is the architect. And he pointed out that on buildings, generally people talk about who the architect was and that's whose name is connected to the building. And nobody tends to remember who the construction manager was. And it seems that at Berkshire, people are identifying Buffett, the construction manager, with Berkshire and less so Charlie, the architect. And he wanted to rectify that identification and give Charlie basically all of the credit for what Berkshire has become, that they were a partnership and that Buffett frequently, he pointed out, made mistakes by going against what Charlie was trying to get him to do and teach him.
Yeah. Is that they both point to maybe a dozen to 15 companies that they've purchased over this 60-year period of time that made Berkshire extraordinary results rather than just mediocre results. So you take those 12, 15 companies out of the picture and you've got a mediocre return. And Warren, many times in his life, has teased Charlie by calling him the abominable no man.
Right.
Where Charlie basically didn't want to buy a great number of companies that Berkshire bought because he didn't. He was holding so rigorously to the standard of wonderful business. We only should buy wonderful businesses. And the mistakes that Berkshire's made over these years have been because they bought something that turned out to not be so wonderful. Mm-hmm. And of course, very difficult necessarily to see that up front. But on hindsight, it's glaring. I can tell you from personal experience. You look back and you just go, what was I thinking? These flaws were there, visible, and I just ignored them. And Charlie maybe is one of the best people in the world at understanding, A, what he doesn't know, and B, fighting confirmation bias and hubris more than any person I think I've ever studied. Just a past master at being willing to challenge and invert his own ideas. And I think much better at that than Buffett. I think Buffett pretty much loves his own ideas.
Yeah,
Charlie takes great pleasure in blowing up his
own
ideas.
Yeah, yeah. As you can see almost by the way Buffett wrote about it, where he said, I kept on reverting to my training from Ben Graham of finding decent companies at fair prices, something like that. Or fair companies at wonderful prices.
Yeah, exactly.
And what Charlie said was, no. Choose a wonderful company at a fair price, a.k.a. Right. Better company, pay more for it, and you're going to do better in the long run.
Right.
And he said his mistakes were finding these great deals on a not-so-great company. And Charlie pointed out, do you remember this, Dad? He pointed out that Charlie, and he put it in caps and bold, Charlie never pointed out his mistakes,
right.
Buffett's mistakes.
Right. Wow, what a marriage that is, huh?
That's wild.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really, really something.
I mean,
take the
grace and the freedom that gives two people to converse about things they disagree on, right? That's a lesson for a partnership. It's just really,
it sure is.
It's really cool.
No, it sure is. So I was going to jump in with something, but I forgot what it was.
Well, we need to wrap up anyway. So
yeah, true.
It's our usual thing, guys, where we forget where we were and then we come back and we move on to a new thing because time has passed. But the weather matrix is not totally done. We're going to get back to finishing that up with your questions and talk a bit more about the Buffett letter, because we haven't even talked about the actual letter. This was just, it was the very important memorial at the beginning of the letter.
We got to talk about using his sister.
Yeah.
As an example of the typical Berkshire owner.
Yeah.
And what
so
that
we'll
person
do, we'll
would
get into that and the weather matrix. And I don't know what order those things are going to happen, but that's the plan.
All right.
Okay.
Cool. Until then.
Go be safe on the hill today.
Yeah, I will. I'm going to go for 9,000. Here we go.
Nice. Nice. All right. Thanks, everybody.
Right,
Have a good week.
So long. Bye.
Bye.
Time to go play. Hi, guys. Thanks for listening to Invested. If you enjoyed this episode and you want more information or to listen to additional episodes, visit our website at investedpodcast.com. And sign up for my virtual workshop right there. Spots are definitely limited for this event. I'm not kidding. They really are. They sell out very quickly. So everything discussed on this podcast, by the way, is either my opinion or it's Danielle's opinion. And it's really important. It's not to be taken as investing advice, because I am not your financial advisor, nor have I considered your personal situation as your fiduciary. So remember that. You're on your own here. This podcast is for your entertainment and education only. And I really hope you enjoyed it.